Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, how Thanksgiving food and customs have evolved. But up front, you'll be hearing a lot today about the pilgrims who fled Europe to North America, seeking religious freedom. But how they held a Thanksgiving feast with local Wampanoag Indians, American Indians, in what is now Plymouth, Massachusetts. But that wasn't the only Thanksgiving, and the very first nationally recognized Thanksgiving wasn't for a bountiful harvest. No, the first nationally recognized Thanksgiving was in York in 1777. Joining us is Christine Cooper, Manager of Public Programs with the York County History Center. Ms. Cooper, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. All right, so let's talk about this first Thanksgiving, the first nationally recognized Thanksgiving in York in 1777. How did that come to be?
Right. Well, there, you know, with the real beginning of the American Revolution, kind of starting in 1775, it was a long road to 1781. And the British end up capturing Philadelphia, which was the capital at the time, in 1777. Congress has to flee. If they were captured, they would have most likely been tried as for treason. They take kind of a big arc. They go up through Reading, down to Lancaster, where they stop for one day. But the state is usually using the courthouse and facilities there. And so they are ferried across the river. There are no bridges across the Susquehanna at that time, which provides a nice, safe barrier for them. So not only are they a 4 days march from Philadelphia, they do have this nice wide river separating them from the enemy. And so they stop in York, use the courthouse there for the work that they need to do during the 9 months of the British occupation. So that's really how Congress ends up in York. The Thanksgiving Proclamation, there have been sort of days of Thanksgiving, you know, since Plymouth, just to celebrate a community celebrating the harvest or certain events. This one was a proclamation issued by Continental Congress with the approval of George Washington and General Gates to celebrate the victory at Saratoga, New York. This was the first major victory of the Revolution, what some people would call the turning point of the war, when 5,000 British soldiers surrender to the Continental Army at Bemis Heights on October 7th, 1777.
So, as I said in the introduction, this Thanksgiving that was declared by or proclaimed by the Continental Congress and approved by General Washington and General Gates, not like the Thanksgivings that we celebrate today or even those that had celebrated bountiful harvest in the past. How was this Thanksgiving observed?
It was actually more of a solemn kind of situation. It was not celebrated with feast or celebration really at all. It was more of a religious observance. The proclamation issued by Congress, you know, does talk about providence, Almighty God, and acknowledging with gratitude our obligations to him for the benefits received. And so it was to be a day of giving thanks to God. And it also talks about repentance. So, you know, we want more good things to happen. So everybody be good, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Does a copy of that proclamation exist today?
Oh, absolutely. I actually have, I have not a real copy, but a copy that I've printed out from the Library of Archives or Library of Congress. And I can read it. It's not very long, if you would like.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. So, In Congress, November 1st, 1777, for as much as it is the indispensable duty of all men to adore the superintending providence of Almighty God, to acknowledge with gratitude their obligations to him for benefits received, and to implore such farther blessings as they stand in need of, and it having pleased him in his abundant mercy, not only to continue to us the innumerable bounties of his common providence, but also to smile upon us in the prosecution of a just and necessary war for the defense and establishment of our unalienable rights and liberties, particularly in that he hath been pleased in so great a measure to prosper the means used for the support of our troops and to crown our arms with most signal success. It is therefore recommended to the legislative or executive powers of the United States to set apart Thursday, the 18th day of December next, for solemn thanksgiving and praise, that at one time and with one voice, the good people may express the grateful feelings of their hearts and consecrate themselves to the service of their divine benefactor, and that together with their sincere acknowledgments and offerings, they may join the penitent concession of their sins, whereby they had forfeited every favor, and their humble and earnest supplications, that it may please God through the merits of Jesus Christ mercifully to forgive and blot them out of remembrance, that it may please him graciously to afford this blessing on the governments of these states respectively, and prosper the public council of the whole, to inspire our commanders both by land and sea, and all under them with that wisdom and fortitude which may render them fit instruments under the providence of Almighty God, to secure for these United States the greatest of all human blessings, independence and peace, that it may please him to prosper the trade and manufactures of the people and the labor of the husbandmen, that our land may yield its increase, to take schools and seminaries of education so necessary for cultivating the principles of true liberty, virtue, and piety under his nurturing hand, and to prosper the means of religion for the promotion and enlargement of that kingdom, which consisteth in righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Ghost. And it is further recommended that servile labor and such recreations as, though at other times innocent, may be unbecoming, the purpose of this appointment may be omitted on so solemn an occasion by order of Congress, Henry Lawrence, President.
Now that is a proclamation of Thanksgiving. they had a lot of reasons to be thankful during that time in York in 1777. You said that General Washington and General Gates also approved that. I know that in York, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, but there's a historic marker in downtown New York talking about the first Thanksgiving. There's also one near Valley Forge outside of Philadelphia, talking about that Thanksgiving proclaimed by the Continental Congress. There's a church where I attended a wedding that talked about how the Continental Army troops had gone by that church and had observed that first Thanksgiving in 1777. Talk about, as I said, there is that historic marker. It was missing for a while because it was being cleaned, I understand, but it is there now, right?
The one in York?
Yes.
Yes. Actually, I think that was the one that may have been hit by a car and knocked down. So it is outside the replica of the colonial courthouse that was built in 1754 in York County. That building is where, well, it's a replica. It's not on the original site, but that courthouse was where Continental Congress met and worked during the time that they met in York. Also of note, right across the street from the courthouse, or the replica courthouse, is what we call the General Horatio Gates House. It is a townhome built in the 1750s where General Horatio Gates lived for a few months that he was here in York. Gates was the commander of the Continental Army at the Battle of Saratoga, or Bemis Heights, I should say. The Saratoga was a long and drawn out campaign, but the deciding battle was Bemis Heights, and he was actually in command there. So we have connections to not only the Thanksgiving Proclamation, but the man who's sort of brought it about.
Is the first Thanksgiving that proclamation by the Continental Congress? Is it known outside of your county, and really even inside your county, that this was a historic event that in the history of this country? Is it well known outside of your county?
The Saratoga is the proclamation, not so much. If you kind of look for Thanksgiving Proclamation of 1777, you have to dig pretty deep to come up with the actual proclamation to find anything else about it. When George Washington was president, he did issue another national Thanksgiving, and that's the one that you'll probably hear more about.
Hmm. Christine Cooper is manager of public programs with the York County History Center. Christine, does York celebrate this anniversary of the first Thanksgiving at all, or is it just something that is acknowledged?
Well, the History Center does in a way. Each year we have, not this year, but we do have an event for families at the courthouse to celebrate the Articles of Confederation, which were adopted November 15th, 1777. And so, you know, since it's usually a couple of days or weeks away from our traditional Thanksgiving, we do talk about the proclamation a little bit, and especially as it's something that Congress sort of brought to pass.
Hmm. Christine Cooper, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Join beloved icon Julie Andrews for story time tomorrow at 9. Julie and her daughter, children's author and educator Emma Walton Hamilton, invite you into their library to read their favorite children's books. That's tomorrow at 9. Yes, that's normally when we would hear Smart Talk, but that's tomorrow at 9 on the holiday. When the Pilgrims who settled in Massachusetts sat down with the local Native Americans in 1621, what was on the menu? Probably not turkey, as most Americans will eat tomorrow. That Thanksgiving was much different than what we observe today in more than just food. We're happy to have on today's program William Wise Weaver. Mr. Weaver is an internationally known food ethnographer and author of 20 books dealing with culinary history and heritage seeds. He is founder of the Roughwood Table, a nonprofit organization devoted to heritage foods with heritage seeds. William Wise Weaver, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a message or a comment on WITF's Twitter feed. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that's at smarttalkwitf. That phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Okay, before we go any further, Mr. Weaver, I have to ask this question, because there may be some who are not familiar with the term ethnographer. What is an ethnographer?
Food ethnography asks the question, what does it mean? As opposed to, let's say, a culinary historian who would describe the contents of an old cookbook. The ethnographer is interested in the people and how they interpret the food. What does it mean to them? These are basically sociological questions, but they they take us into very interesting areas of research. Does that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely. But I'm going to ask you to put on your culinary historian hat for just a moment before we talk about the people at what is recognized as the first Thanksgiving feast. Let's go back to 1621. The people known as the Pilgrims, the Puritans, and the Native Americans who showed up a little bit later at that feast. What was on the menu?
Well, if you go to Plymouth Plantation, you will probably receive a long lecture on that first Thanksgiving, which was not recorded very well. Most likely, there was some venison because the Indians liked to eat venison. Probably there was some kind of corn dish and perhaps some squash. The pilgrims themselves brought animals from England, so they probably had some mutton or perhaps some pork. It wasn't the meal that we know today as Thanksgiving dinner. It was basically cobbled together from what they had on hand at that time. And you have to realize, at that point in the settlement of New England, it was very, very primitive, touch and go. So that first Thanksgiving was more or less a religious ceremony, in a sense, giving thanks that they had gotten that far with their settlement. It wasn't necessarily a positive thing for the Indians. They were trying to help the settlers. But as we know, the Puritans became very, very adamant in their attitude towards Indians who were not Christians. And this resulted in all kinds of Indian wars in New England and all kinds of unhappy things. So there are two sides to that original Thanksgiving story. There were winners and there were losers, unfortunately, but that's history.
Yeah, the story that we were taught as children growing up about this great celebration may not have been reality. In fact, just here in the last few days, I've read several historic accounts that have said the Indians showed up a little bit later. They weren't invited to the feast, and they came with the venison that you had described. But I also noticed that turkey was not on that menu for the very first Thanksgiving. Why not?
Well, the only turkeys, I'm not quite sure why not, but the only turkeys that you could cook in those days were the wild ones. And I'm not sure what the Indians' attitude towards turkey was in New England, but I know that in our region, among the Lenape, there was a group. They were divided into three groups, and one of them, their totem was the turkey. So they would never eat their totem because that was in Native American religion. That was who they were related to. So there may have been a taboo in New England among the Indians to eat turkey. I don't know. I'm just guessing there. This turkey thing evolved because by the late 18th century, a roast of some kind, something very impressive brought to the table, a goose, a turkey, a ham. But this turkey in New England becomes a sort of symbol of this congregationalist religious meal. You have to realize the Thanksgiving that we know started in the Congregationalist Church, and it was really a New England thing for a long time, and it wasn't celebrated at all in Pennsylvania for sure until after the Civil War. So there's a long sort of timeline and evolution here.
I'm going to jump around a little bit from era to era, decade to decade on you. But when you say that Thanksgiving was mostly a New England thing, celebrated in the New England states, what was Harvest Home? I understand that was a celebration.
Yes. Harvest Home was the our local version of what the New Englanders called Thanksgiving. And this was a festival held in the church where the crops were brought in, or examples of canning and cakes, what have you. They were put in the front of the church up by the altar and blessed. So it was basically blessing of the harvest. And this is a medieval custom that traces back to England. And this is what Pennsylvanians knew. And in fact, in my cookbook, Dutch Treats, I have a picture at the back of a harvest home from 1926 in the, I think it's Klingelstown. Yes, Klingelstown, Church of God, 1926. It's a beautiful photograph which sort of captures the meaning of that. So even when Thanksgiving, it becomes more of a national celebration, even in the 1920s and 30s, local churches in Pennsylvania were still doing Harvest Home. That for them was Thanksgiving.
So when did the two merge, and maybe there were other celebrations or observations in other parts of the country?
Well, Thanksgiving, you know, originally was a New England thing, but New Englanders moved west, and they took it with them to Ohio and Illinois, upper Midwest, that kind of thing. What we noticed is that because New Englanders traveled a lot, hotels, even in Pennsylvania, would often provide a Thanksgiving dinner, even though it wasn't local custom, but they would do it for these travelers. And one of the first Thanksgiving menus that I've been able to locate was held in a Philadelphia hotel in 1843. But it was a big banquet that was paid for or celebrated by the Sons of New England. In other words, this was a gentleman's club of New Englanders who happened to live in Philadelphia, and they wanted to celebrate something that they knew from back home. Let's go back to York for just 1 minute. The person in Congress who suggested that first Thanksgiving was Samuel Adams, and he was a New Englander. So in a sense, that first Thanksgiving that was discussed earlier, that Christine talked about, was inspired by the New England version. So that's a very interesting launching pad for this whole celebration, because it really didn't become a national thing until the Civil War, and I believe Abraham Lincoln declared a Thanksgiving. The country was in bad shape during the Civil War, and there was a lot of financial problems. I mean, people were really poor because it broke the economy, and so there was a need for pulling the country together. And I think that patriotic tone to the Thanksgiving that was observed during the Civil War gave it a broader base, a more popularity after the Civil War, because you start to see Thanksgiving appearing on menus in hotels and in various parts of the country. And Harvest Home gradually disappears, even in Pennsylvania. I would say by the 1940s, churches don't do it or weren't doing it, but now there is a return. There is interest in going back to this old custom. So we're in a state of flux right now. Of course, the Thanksgiving meal that we know, with turkey and pumpkin pie and all of that, that evolved in New England. And it was more or less something that was created in the 18th century.
I'm going to talk about some of those.
It doesn't
talk about some of those things, too. But
yes?
You had mentioned menus that amongst the many things that you do is that you collect old menus. We have photographs that you have provided to us on our website, WITF.org, of that Washington House Thanksgiving from 1843. As you said, it was something that was inspired by those traveling from New England. But there are a few items on this menu that I just had to ask about. Okay, let me just go some of the ones that stuck out to me. Now, there is boiled turkey in celery sauce that is listed on the menu, but leg of mutton in caper sauce, tongue with jelly, calf's head in egg sauce. Now that those are all boiled, and then over on the roast side, there are a few things here that sound really good, like filet of veal, spare ribs of pork with applesauce, but pig with liver sauce, that doesn't sound very appetizing to me. Tell us about some of those items I just read off and items that are on. By the way, this is a long menu. Some of the items that were on that 1843 menu.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me, but I do recall, for example, there was an attempt to make this very New England, and right in the middle of the whole menu is a baked beans, Boston baked beans. They tried to this whole menu was cobbled together, I think, by several caterers, because if those of our listeners go online and look at it, you'll see it's long. It's very big. I think the basic method of service was that you either it was done buffet style or you chose one thing from each category. It was all a la carte, so this was quite an expensive meal, no matter how you cut it. The pastries in particular. Oh, there's ice cream, vanilla ice cream and lemon ice cream. Those were the two most popular flavors, and you have to realize that vanilla ice cream was made famous in Philadelphia in the 1820s when the Marquis de Lafayette visited. And they served vanilla ice cream for the first time. So there was a patriotic cut to that ice cream being on the menu, if you will. So you look at that menu and you think of a Chinese menu in a Chinese restaurant where you just take one thing out of each category, because no one human being could eat all that food.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely. I mean, as I said, even today when I walk into a restaurant, back in the days when we did walk into restaurants on a regular basis, you see a long menu and it gets your attention because most menus are not that lengthy today. I had a question here, a couple questions from listeners who looked at that menu. What is American soup?
That's a good question. I have no clue what they meant by American soup. I haven't even found a recipe in any cookbooks called American soup. So I have no clue what's in that. Sorry, but that one draws a blank.
What about
stump the band?
What about bread that is garnished with duck?
Bread garnished with duck.
Yeah. Are you familiar with that one?
I know what they're doing. They're making a fancy loaf of bread, cutting it up into something known as a sippet, and toasting it, and then putting that under duck meat. Okay, so it's basically duck on toast, but it's much larger than that. It's probably a platter full of bread with duck on it.
Obviously, there some of those items that I read off of the menu are things that are not very popular today. What is mutton, by the way?
Mutton?
Yeah.
Elderly sheep.
Okay.
Actually, there was good mutton years ago. It wasn't just lamb. There was mutton raised in Pennsylvania along the river, the Delaware River, in the salt marshes. And so the mutton had, the sheep were eating salt hay, and that gave a very different flavor to the flesh. But mutton basically is elderly sheep, and it can be tough and rank.
It sounds it, you know. Here's a listener question as well. Are there regionally Thanksgiving celebrations that set a table that has foods grown locally? This sounds almost like the harvest that you were talking about. Not necessarily the traditional turkey filling menus?
Well, I would say yes. Over the years, since the turn of the early 1900s, different parts of the country have been developing their own Thanksgiving menus, if you will. I mean, you can go into the Southwest and you'll start finding Mexican things added on to the menu. In Pennsylvania, harvest home dinners didn't even have turkey. I mean, it was basically a pork meal. So there are indeed lots of local nuances, and sweet potato pudding in the South, and also in Pennsylvania, that was very popular as a festive dish. So one could write a book on all of the local nuances to Thanksgiving that have evolved over the years, because Italian Americans put in some Italian dishes. I mean, on and on we go. Does that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, our listeners, if you would like to weigh in on some of the Thanksgiving dishes that maybe are unique to your family, go right ahead. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. You also could send us an email, smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're @smarttalkwitf. Now, you know, you have written, as I mentioned, 20 books, and one of the things that you wrote about was you've written about Philadelphia, for example. And when we talk about Thanksgiving in cities, it was different in the city than it was in country areas as well. One reason, people who lived in cities didn't have big kitchens. Why was that significant?
Well, that's a very good point that you bring up. What happened as Thanksgiving became more and more popular is people living in the cities didn't have large kitchens. In fact, they didn't even have large dining rooms. If you look at old Philadelphia row houses or any of the row houses in York or Reading, what have you. So it became a custom to eat out. In other words, a family and all the relatives attached would rent a space at a hotel and have their Thanksgiving dinner there because, well, you don't have to wash the dishes, do you? You leave that up to the hotel people. So there was a convenience thing. However, there was also a financial difference. You had to be able to afford to do that. So the urbanites were celebrating Thanksgiving first before the country people caught up, and they were spending a lot of money on this, and there would be good wines, good beers, imported foods. We know what was on a lot of those menus because people saved them, and I have quite a few in the Philadelphia culinary ephemera collection, which I think at this point consists of about 16,000 items. It's monumental, and I hope someday it'll be a research tool for food historians. But anyway, we can look at those menus and we can see what was being put on them. And yes, the hotels did start to follow that New England pattern of a turkey in some form anyway, stuffing, baked potatoes, some sort of vegetable side dish, and of course, pumpkin pie. Pumpkin pie, by the way, isn't really a pie. In Baroque cooking, it would have been considered a tart. because it's really a baked pudding. It's something akin to a custard, but we call it a pie. Pie in the old days was something that had a top crust to it and often had whole birds or fish in it. It was a completely different kind of thing. So this is an Americanism we have to explain when we were in England, that our pumpkin pie is what they would call a tart or a pudding. But anyhow, that kind of menu format becomes rather standard. And then we have the magazines like Ladies' Home Journal being published in Philadelphia, and they pick up on these themes. And there are articles on what to do for Thanksgiving. What are the interesting things you can prepare? We always had oyster pie. I mean, that was something that we served in Chester County. And there was always some kind of a parsnip dish, because parsnips do very well here. So even in Pennsylvania, there are a lot of localisms. And among the Pennsylvania Dutch, I'm quite sure they had gefilsel, which is stuffing, but it's not stuffed in anything. It's baked like a pudding, and it has mashed potatoes and maybe have shredded chicken in it. Lots of butter, of course. And perhaps even a pig stomach stuffed, zymoa, as it's called. So there are all kinds of regionalisms that make this this time of year an interesting one to study.
We're going to talk more about that in just
a
moment.
How's that for an answer?
That's I love it. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I want to also talk about another program that is coming up in place of Smart Talk on Friday at 9 a.m., the program We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives, Memories from JFK's Confidants, recorded just after the assassination in 1963. That's coming up Friday at 9 on WITF. Our guest during this portion of the program, the day before Thanksgiving, William Woys Weaver. He's a culinary historian, author, ethnographer, I should say, and heirloom foods preservationist. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mr. Weaver, we received several emails from you, the audience. My father, Christine in York, says, my father was a pastor in York during the 1960s. I have vivid memories of the beautiful harvest home display in the church every year. The food was given to the pastor's family, I assume, to make up for the fact that the pastor was so woefully underpaid. Another listener says the church in Derry Township, that's near Hummelstown, just south of Hershey, was celebrating harvest home through the 1950s. Let's see. Talked about some suggestions for how Thanksgiving is celebrated in different regions, different cultures. This listener says, my fiance and I just moved to Lancaster, and we are from different parts of the world. Personally, I was born and raised in Hawaii, and I eat turkey with rice instead of mashed potatoes. I am part Asian and Native Hawaiian. Instead of pumpkin pie, my family makes a chocolate halpia pie. Halpia is a Hawaiian coconut dessert that has a texture like flan. And she says, this is Carly. And Lancaster says, happy Thanksgiving to all of us here in listening on WITF. So what do you think about that, Mr. Weaver, some of the things that you just heard?
I think that's wonderful. And this is precisely the kind of regional variation that I was referring to earlier on, that each part of the country has tweaked this Thanksgiving meal and added to it things which relate to their own either ethnic identity or regional culture. I'd like to add also that one of the Pennsylvania Dutch takes on the turkey is stuffing it with sauerkraut. And that's a very popular Thanksgiving dish, even in Baltimore. And I interviewed the Baltimore newspaper about that. But using the sauerkraut in a turkey really goes back, let's say, to the German custom of stuffing sauerkraut into a goose. So that's probably how this whole idea evolved. But that's one of our regionalisms on the Thanksgiving menu.
You know, what I'm curious about is how we got away from some of these things. Like, goose seems to be a popular item, you know, maybe pre-1930s, maybe even before that, in the 19th century. How did we get away from eating geese?
Well, goose was actually the most popular festival food for Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, even at Easter. And there are a lot of records about the raising geese. Turkeys, by the way, were wild. So to get a turkey, you had to hunt. It wasn't until the end of the 19th century that the domesticated turkeys became less expensive because of the, you might say, industrialization of the poultry industry. So once the farmers figured out inexpensive ways to raise this domesticated turkey, it becomes more or less the standard bird for the menu. I asked my grandmother about turkey, and she said her father, he was a Chester County Quaker, he was a pork butcher, tried to raise turkeys, but the wild turkeys didn't do well. They got sick. They didn't thrive in a farming situation. So I think there was a problem with production, let's just put it that way, in getting turkeys out there. But once that was solved, turkey, like chicken, has become more or less very inexpensive. It's very expensive up until the day after Thanksgiving. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I've wondered often, there are so many grocery stores and chains that give away turkeys when you accumulate a certain number of points or buy a certain amount, whether anyone actually buys turkeys anymore, if they're all given away. That's another show. Another listener says, when did cranberry relish become a staple?
Well, cranberries are common in New England, but also here in Pennsylvania, because they were growing them over in New Jersey. You're going to find cranberry tarts, cranberry relish, cranberry pies, what have you, on menus, Christmas menus, even in the 18th century. So that dish has been around for a long time. Again, it was highly seasonal because you only had cranberries in the fall. But the cranberry sauce has become one of those fixtures of the Thanksgiving dinner, for certain.
You mentioned earlier about how what we consider pumpkin pie today actually isn't a pie, that is more of a tart, or would be referred to in Europe as a tart, and would be pudding. You also mentioned that there are differences in pumpkin pie between New England and Pennsylvania Dutch here in central Pennsylvania. What are some of the differences?
Well, the New England pumpkin pie is basically pureed pumpkin, and then you add eggs. It's basically a pumpkin custard. The Pennsylvania Dutch pumpkin pie, as it was made, let's say, in the 19th century and down into perhaps World War I period, was basically like pumpkin focaccia, may I put it that way. You had yeast-raised dough, it could be sweet, and then you had sliced pumpkins put on top, and then perhaps some sour cream and egg beaten together and poured over it, and then that was baked. So it was basically, how about pumpkin pizza? It looked like a pizza pie, and that it was baked out of, in, you know, the outdoor bake oven, and these were large. In other words, they were made to feed maybe 20 people. They weren't little dainty tarts like we make today. So that was one difference, big difference.
Another question, how was the meat birds treated to keep them from spoiling, since there was no household refrigeration?
Well, this is a butchering question that you're asking me. The butchering basically took place in the fall and in winter when the weather was cold. So you weren't doing this in the summer when meat could go off. In the old days, if you went to the farmer's market, let's say in Harrisburg, I have a wonderful found a wonderful description of it. The turkeys, the birds, there was game, venison for sale. It wasn't dressed. You bought the animal with the guts inside and the feathers on it. You had to take it home and clean it. So the butchering took place shortly before point of sale, let's put it that way. So there wasn't a lot of time involved in getting that meat into the oven. It didn't sit around for a couple days, let's put it that way. But also, most farms had spring houses, and they were cool. They served as the refrigerator for keeping things from spoiling. Milk, what have you, it was all put in that spring house. And there are often references in the colonial records to people stealing meat and what have you out of these spring houses. So this is where people put things, and it didn't go off because the spring water was what, about 40 degrees, about the same temperature as your refrigerator.
We only have a couple minutes left. Mr. Weaver, you are one of the nation's leading, if not the, heirloom seeds collectors. Tell us about that. I mean, an heirloom foods preservationist. Tell us about collecting seeds. And I mean, you have some seeds from Native America. Well, just tell us about your collection.
Well, my grandfather started collecting seeds during the Depression in order to grow food for our starving relatives who didn't have work. Turns out he was getting seeds from relatives and from friends like Horace Pippin, the African-American artist. Turns out that these seeds he was collecting were heirlooms, and they were wonderful. I inherited that collection and added to it. We now have started in 1932. It's the largest private seed collection in Pennsylvania. It may be also in the East. We have the largest collection of Native American seeds in the country, and we work closely with Native American groups to help them maintain their heritage foods, because it's very important in Native American religion. Our seed manager is part Cherokee, so we have a wonderful link through him to the various tribes. We have all of the squash and beans and corn that the Lenape Indians raised, those that survive. So it has grown and grown and grown, and we're looking for ways to promote these heirloom plants, because they are the flavor of the food in the past. You can't go to the Acme and recreate an 18th century dish with the vegetables that are being sold there. You have to use the heirloom vegetables that were used in that period. They taste differently. The meat's much different. On and on we go. We don't deal with heritage animals, but I can tell you I have baked with Native American corn, and the flavor is totally different from what you get with cornmeal that's been in a store for 3 months or 8 months that just tastes like the bag it's in.
William Woys Weaver, so interesting. Thank you very much for being with us today, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you very much. Same to you.
Coming up tomorrow, I just want to say happy Thanksgiving to everyone out there, and we will talk to you on Monday. So have a great holiday and a great weekend. I'm Scott Lamar.